Welcome back to TYT. Anna Kasparian, J.R. Jackson, and Grace Baldridge with you.
Abby wanted to stay, and I said, no, you leave. I'm sitting in. Mm-hmm. That's what happened.
Yeah.
True story.
It's not just go time, it's your time.
Oh, that was,
yeah, man.
I forgot.
A lot of the audience probably doesn't even know what that reference is.
I don't even know what that reference is. I teased you about it once and I felt bad, so I stopped.
No, it's so good. Okay, so just quick background story. One time during our current days, I got to fill in for Cenk and be like the lead host of the current TV show. And so I opened it. Cenk would always open each show with, it's go time. And when I did it, I was like, it's not just go time, it's my time, or something like that. Something super cheesy.
And then the steam came from the bag. And then
I made everyone clap for me, like Cenk did in the first episode of the current show. Anyway, he didn't make people
did
clap.
Did people vote on that, or were you like, executive decision, this will work?
There was other powers.
I okay. feel like someone put it in my head,
gotcha.
And I was like,
okay.
Oh, that, I thought you meant the whole steam and stuff. No, it was. I liked it.
I loved it. I thought it was great.
It's my time. It does sound like the beginning of like you starting a sports franchise though. Like if you were to announce that it's like a league of Kasparians and it was like all like starting your own dodgeball league. Be like, it's my time.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you were announcing your, you know, debut into world wrestling, which I fully support. I know you're in shape, you could do it.
I am not in shape, actually. In the post-game show today, I want to talk about a condition that I've developed in my glute. My right glute.
In your butt?
Yeah, yeah. It's just
develop
nice.
Develop the condition.
Cool.
You don't want to miss it.
How
if you want to be a
teaser?
Member, go to tytnetwork.com/join. Okay, yeah. We have a ton of stories, so let's get to it. All right. The fraternity at the University of Virginia, which was the subject of a super questionable and incorrect Rolling Stone piece about campus rape, has settled a defamation lawsuit with Rolling Stone to the tune of $1.65 million. Now, this, of course, had to do with the Virginia Alpha Kappa. The Virginia Alpha chapter of Phi Kappa Psi. That was a fraternity that was written about in the article, and it alleged that there was a gang rape of a female student who went by the name of Jackie. The issue with the piece was that the writer did not talk to anyone except for Jackie, the woman who alleged that she had been gang raped by this fraternity. And so when the story came out, there were a number of people, including the alleged victim's friends, who came out and said, this is not true. And at that point, Rolling Stone had to retract their piece. And of course, they faced some defamation lawsuits because they, you know, ruined the reputations of individuals who were part of this reporting. Now, the Virginia Alpha chapter of Phi Kappa Psi fraternity has agreed to settle and dismiss its defamation lawsuit against Rolling Stone and Sabrina Erdley, that is the writer, of course, arising from the magazine's publication of the November 2014 article, A Rape on Campus, A Brutal Assault and Struggle for Justice at UVA, the fraternity said in a statement. Now, the magazine also settled another lawsuit earlier this year with a former University of Virginia associate dean, Nicole Aramo, who claimed she was defamed by the story as well. Now, the article claimed that, you know, she didn't take the accusation seriously. There wasn't a proper investigation done. And so, rightfully so, she went after Rolling Stone for defamation and they settled the case as well. Now, even though I completely agree that Rolling Stone did not do the right thing and that was incredibly unethical and irresponsible journalism, I didn't want that one story to destroy the publication because Rolling Stone, you know, has really great writers, including Matt Taibbi. And I just didn't want to see the entire, you know, publication go down the drain because of the irresponsible behavior of, you know, a few editors and a writer. So I'm happy to see that the settlement is not, it doesn't seem like it's going to break the bank for them, $1.65 million. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, diving into this, the Columbia Journalism Review did a really good sort of play-by-play of exactly what went wrong, and it's really frustrating to read through because it calls into question, unfortunately, for a lot of people, it gave them license to question the testimony of sexual assault victims, and that's what is so heartbreaking about this. And I think that the people at Rolling Stone, the editors behind it, and the writer themselves have all acknowledged that. I mean, it's the implications, the ramifications of this story are so tragic, just beyond this falsehood. And I know what they were doing. They were acting in deference to try and respect who they thought was, who presented themselves as a sexual assault victim.
Right.
And I understand that. And it's one of those things where you have to question, okay, if I were in these shoes, what would I do? Because you have this person who's saying, I'm a victim, please don't reach out to these people.
Yeah.
I can, and then down the line, after the story's already in the pipeline, ready to be published, then some questions come up where she can't really remember the spelling of the person that she's saying instigated the whole event. That's really fishy, but what do you do? The story's already going to be published. You know, it's possible that she's forgetting some details. It's just all of this snowballed into something that really is, the effects I think we're still seeing today, because whenever we cover a story, I know even on this channel, about rape or sexual assault, there are a lot of people that will cite statistics, bogus statistics, like, yeah, most people are faking it anyway. Look at the UVA case.
Exactly.
Most people
right.
are lying
yeah.
anyway.
You don't want to give
so
those
sad.
People fodder. And
it's,
unfortunately,
and that's what this
yeah.
did. Yeah.
It's consequences 101 for this, as we've said many times. You don't want to, I guess, poison the field for when it really has happened. Because even before any kind of false allegations even arise, there's already a suppression of victims
yes.
of rape already, just because we have this society that wants to demonize someone who was a victim of a crime like this already for some reason. There's plenty of reasons, and we know those. But then after it's all said and done, it still ends up, this is what struck me in this as well. The author, or the journalist for this, who I was wanting to see what happened to her. She kind of like, I figured she went away, she working anywhere ever again. When it comes to consequences, for Rolling Stone, what happens to her as well as her career? And she was forced to go in hiding or receiving threats, of course. I wonder which kind of threat she received as a woman. So even after it's all said and done and you're in the wrong, from Rolling Stone to the writer of the piece, then she still gets the same threats that lead to things that she was writing about in the first place. So
yeah.
both sides end up having to recreate the bad sides of this whole thing. But when it comes to false allegations, or when it comes to shooting death threats at a woman just because she's a woman, and I wouldn't want to see the kinds of threats that she received from this.
And I think that she was very close to this. She got very close with Jackie. They spoke a number of times, they met a number of times. So I also think that it's important to call out her editors, who were less close, yeah. to look at this as fact checkers and be like, okay, she says this, can we double check this? Can we go
yeah,
make sure that he was a lifeguard at this point in time? I need to look at this objectively. You know, you have to look, to a certain level, you have to be a little bit cold about it, a little bit cold
yeah.
and callous and cynical that maybe she's lying. And I think that her editors didn't really do that job, because we, and I don't think it's wrong to treat people who say that they have been sexually assaulted respectfully and to treat them, I don't know, it's a delicate situation, but someone should have been fact checking along the way.
I absolutely agree with you. And I would argue that it's even more cold and callous to depict this bleak criminal picture of innocent individuals, right? And that's essentially what happened with this piece, which is why it's so incredibly important to not rely on one source and one source only for a piece. You have to corroborate it. And that pertains to every type of story. If someone is leaking something to you, right? You can't just simply rely on what that one leaker says. And I know a lot of publications, New York Times, a lot of established publications make sure that they corroborate what that source is saying before they publish the piece, because anyone can say anything. And if you just take that for face value or at face value when you publish it, well, it's not ethical or responsible journalism. And look, I think that this story, the fact that the settlement came about today is really interesting to me, because it made me kind of go back in time, 2014, when this was a big story. And it made me realize that journalism as a whole has devolved so much, even in the short period of time since this entire thing blew up, right? You see all sorts of defamatory stuff in the media about anyone, right? About any politician, about anyone who's in the news or who's yeah. in the headlines at that moment. You see a bunch of, you know, so-called journalists trying to make the story about them because they're trying to make a name for themselves, as opposed to actually just reporting the facts, right? And instead of, you know, pushing their agenda, they should be focusing on stories that matter to the American public so they can be well-informed, you know, participants of a democratic system. And we've moved so far away from that. Like, and it's not just television media, it's not just establishment media, it's media in general now. It doesn't matter if you're in digital media or television or print, I see dishonest actors everywhere. And it's just really devastating to me, because, you know, I realize that, you know, you, if you're a public figure, your reputation is not in your hands anymore, okay? Your reputation is in the hands of everyone else who decide what the narrative is, who decide what type of person you are, who decide to cover you in any way they decide to cover you, right? And that's the worst part about it. Because it doesn't matter if you're a good person, doesn't matter if you have the best intentions. I mean, look what happened today with Bernie Sanders, right? Bernie Sanders is getting blamed for a shooting at like a congressional baseball practice. And he has never once condoned violence. He has never once encouraged or incited violence. But other people get to draw this narrative of him. And it's irresponsible behavior.
We're already in our corners. So, and I think John tweeted it today when he said, these type of things allow people to cobble in their corners. And then once they're there, they use it for their own perspective and their own angle to prove that their corner is the best corner. And no one's ever going to speak.
Yeah, and we rely on journalists to be the watchdogs for this. And going with a dog analogy, because I love dogs, it was sort of like Rolling Stone got caught chasing their own tail.
Yeah, I love dogs too.
Yep. There you go.
And actually, I'd want to also, the fraternity said that they're donating a significant amount of the 1.65 to charities that help with victims
of sexual assault.
Yeah, and good. Victims,
yeah. I really do commend the fraternity for how they handled this, and I can't imagine how difficult it was when they were being accused for something that they didn't do.
I mean, frats do enough stuff that
that's true.
They
that's
should
true.
Be in trouble for.
That, but that
you can't paint with a broad stroke. You can't. You know what I mean?
No, all I'm saying is they have enough trouble already that they do get themselves in.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Let's not add on to it with fake stuff. Yeah, I agree.
Right.
They were gonna mess up eventually.
All right, let's move on to something a little different. During the Obama administration, there were some important regulations put in place pertaining to for-profit colleges. Now, these are different from public colleges or private colleges. For-profit colleges are run much like corporations. They have investors and they want to make as much money as possible. And the money that they make usually makes individuals who are involved in the business wealthy, as opposed to going back into coffers for the school. So just so you know what for-profit colleges are. Now, there were a lot of controversial issues over the years regarding how these for-profit colleges were intentionally deceptive toward students that they were attempting to recruit. So they would show them job placement statistics that were misleading. To give you a quick example, if someone was going to one of these schools to study how to be a chef, they would show job placement rates at like 85%. In reality, those statistics included individuals who were working at fast food companies, literally flipping burgers. And so, of course, that's deceptive, especially when they convince a lot of students to take out very, very large federal loans. A lot of these schools relied on federal loans in order to make up their revenue. And for some schools, it was as much as 95% of their revenue. So taxpayers were being hurt by this, because where do you think that revenue comes from? And also students were being hurt by this, because they were digging themselves in this gigantic hole for a program that wouldn't actually place them in a job that would give them a decent earning potential. Now, with that said, Obama finally did something about it. And so there was something called gainful employment, which ensured that if a school is to receive any type of federal funding, they have to have a certain ratio among the number of students enrolling and the number of students who actually get placed in gainful employment after they graduate. The second part of it was a debt forgiveness program for those who were misled by these recruiters, those who were the victims of this fraudulent behavior. Now, fast forward to the Trump administration.
What could go wrong?
The Education Department has decided to put a hold on these rules. Department officials will block a rule that clarifies how student borrowers can have their loans forgiven if they were defrauded or misled by their college. The administration will issue a stay of borrower defense under Section 705 of the Administrative Procedure Act, which an education department official said allows federal agencies to halt the effective date of a rule pending judicial review. Now, the loan forgiveness component of all of this was supposed to go into effect July 1st. Betsy DeVos comes in. She has been very, very sympathetic to for-profit colleges, was not in favor of regulating them whatsoever. She was actually very transparent about that. She comes in and says, no, we're not doing this, okay? So real quick, let's hear from Betsy DeVos. She says, it is the department's aim and this administration's commitment to protect students from predatory practices while also providing clear, fair, and balanced rules for colleges and universities to follow. Let's keep it real. This is really about protecting for-profit colleges and ensuring that your buddies, you know, continue making as much money as possible with taxpayer-funded loans that are given to these students. And by the way, these loans aren't going to be forgiven. She claims that they will be if they qualify, but it seems like she's not very sympathetic toward the students.
It's not like we have a president that has any interest or a history in taking part in for-profit colleges or any kind of institution of higher learning where he made money off people and defrauded them.
Where
that didn't happen, did it?
Where he exploited people who were specifically looking to better their lives, who were looking for better opportunities. Trump University is the epitome of what for-profit colleges are. They're despicable, okay? Which is why Corinthian colleges went down the drain recently in 2015, because they were defrauding students. They were screwing them over, and students weren't able to pay back their loans because they couldn't find gainful employment. They were told that they were promised the moon and the stars, right? And these recruiting techniques, I don't know if you guys ever watch daytime television, but they're clever, right? They go after very specific shows and a very specific demographic because they know that these people are desperate. They know that these people want to better their lives. And so they'll promise the moon and the stars and they'll be like, no, don't worry about it. Take out those student loans. It's gonna be great.
And many of the people in the audience that they're targeting maybe have had setbacks, maybe did other college or other kind of school, and like, I'm behind. I'm 22 years old already.
Yes.
I gotta do this. And by the way, that's still young. But still, you target people and think, I gotta catch up. And it's the quick and easy way. And the quick and easy way, and many times, especially with education, isn't. But they're taking advantage. Now, with the wording that DeVos put in that, with saying they're gonna use something to make it more fair and balanced and create this and do that. The thing with the gray area that no one likes to talk about in politics is, sure, there's probably issues. Like when it came to the healthcare, Obamacare, there was things with it that were absolutely wrong, that didn't work, that it wasn't gonna develop the right way because it gave too much power to people in states that wanted to tank it. So sure, there's things in the way that this could approach that you could clean it up. But what's gonna happen is, the officials that she's gonna appoint are gonna have, they're gonna be free to take whatever approach they want in concerning what's good and what's bad, and then that'll be behind closed doors, because how many people every day are gonna report about what these random nameless department heads are gonna be doing to create the policy the way they want it? Nobody will. Mm-hmm. And we'll look up and go, how did we get that horrible piece of legislation that they said was gonna make everything so much better?
Yeah, so reading through this article, I couldn't believe how on the nose it was for the Trump administration. I thought that it would be a little bit more nuanced and mysterious. But I was reading it through, I was like, they must be trying to veil this in something else, right? Mm-hmm. There's no way they're just going to announce that they're just gutting this. They're not even gonna try and work through it. Again, so much of this is going to be going on behind closed doors with people that Betsy DeVos appoints herself. There's no oversight.
Right.
It is we hired a businessman for president. People thought that was gonna be a good idea.
A businessman to defraud students.
Right, yeah. And now he's doing that exactly that with the people that he put in place with our country. I don't know. It's like that. I feel like that's so obvious. It's such an obvious thing.
They don't have to anymore, because after the campaign and the way he openly said things that he was hoping to get him, would give him a law so he can go back to his life, and it didn't work, they went, oh, they'll go for anything. We don't have to hide anymore. Let's just say what we're gonna do and they're gonna go, yay.
But also think about, look, this affects everyone, regardless of whether or not you have student loan debt. Because if you genuinely care about the economy and how it works, you need people to spend money. You need people to stimulate the economy. And right now, there's a huge problem with, you know, $1.3 trillion in student loan debt. And when we are strapped with that, it's really difficult to go out there and buy a car or a home or get your life started and actually stimulate this so-called economy that we have, right? So everyone gets affected. But more importantly, younger generations, because of the fact that, you know, tuition has shot up so much over the last, you know, 10 years, younger generations are hurt the most personally, right? And younger generations didn't vote for Trump. So, you know, if you're concerned about this being, you know, something that serves as a political ramification later on down the line, It's not, because these are people who typically wouldn't vote for Trump anyway, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't think they're going to look
Which
at this.
Could be why it's easily overlooked. I mean, remember he went on his thank you tour only to states that he won as soon as he won the election. He talked about how he had his friends. He goes, I just want to help my friends. Literally, again, all this stuff is said right now.
That's what I can't believe. Like, they must have at least had some sort of a code language. It's not even coded. It's very transparent what's happening here.
Yes, totally. I feel like every time they're on camera, it's like, just come to my one shot. It's almost as if they're just like, we're gonna fuck you. We're gonna fuck you real good. And you're gonna like it. And the people are like, yeah, boom, we're gonna vote for him. I love Trump, Trump's so great. MAGA. It's amazing. Anyway, all right, guys, I'm gonna leave you with that and go to our break. But when we come back, more stories for you. Including mass incarceration. What's going on with that issue? I'll give you the deets. Welcome back to TYT. Anna, JR, and Grace with you. Later on, we will have a members only postgame show for our members. And you don't want to miss it. So go to tytnetwork.com/join to watch our conversation about glute issues. Among other things, by the way.
It sounds like you're saying gluten issues. Like
No, I do not have a gluten allergy or
anything like
that.
We're just gonna be eating bread and getting real constipated during the postgame.
And then there's also TYT Classics, where we watch an old school clip and comment on it. All right, Gabby Marita says, A League of Casparians sounds like a femme-only superhero group that goes around paying college tuition to indebted students.
Fuck yeah, I'd do that.
It's a freaking fantasy of mine, actually. No, you know what my fantasy is? To destroy the for-profit prison industry. It's gonna happen. I'm gonna find a way. I don't know how, but I'm gonna destroy them. Also, Only Love Prevail says, not only has journalism devolved, but many of the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really. And then finally, Chilean Babcock says, I think Trump feels no guilt in cashing in on his position because his base showed him how gullible they were. Well, his base also doesn't really care about him cashing in on his position. They just don't care. Like, they don't care about Russia. They don't care about that issue. They don't care about conflicts of interest. They don't care about nepotism. I feel like the only thing they care about is feeling like their voices are heard. And unfortunately, he was the only one in the general election that recognized them in any way. I mean, he's gonna fuck you. He's gonna fuck you good. But he recognized
you. We have a theme
today. Yeah. Anyway,
just
sorry
so
for the cursing. You know, I cleaned up my language
this
for so long.
This is after that.
What happened?
Just remember the ad.
Wait, they see that too?
That's the whole point.
They see that.
That's the entire point.
Everyone sees it.
Yeah.
Wait, you think we play ads for us?
I don't know what they were doing there.
Apparently not, no.
That's mortifying.
Tweet Grace about how much you love that ad because it was fun.
It was fun.
And awesome.
All right, back to Anna.
All right, let's talk about mass incarceration. A new study using statistics from the Department of Justice or the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that whenever we talk about mass incarceration, we typically focus on big cities and, you know, urban areas where massive jails and prisons are located. But we never really focus on one of the biggest issues, which is jails in rural areas and smaller towns. Now, this study found some really interesting information, and I want to share it with you. So these local jails, mostly serving rural communities with low crime rates, hold a disproportionate number of people who are waiting for trial and who are being held by outside agencies such as overburdened state prison systems and US Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So these communities generally lack the resources to steer low-level offenders away from pretrial detention, and many expand their jail capacities to win a bigger share of contracts from outside agencies. So obviously money talks, and
yes.
When it comes to imprisoning people, I think that it's clear to a lot of people, both on the right and the left, that there's now an incentive structure. There's a profit motive, mm-hmm. and imprisoning more people means more money. And they don't really care about how many lives it destroys. They don't care about the fact that a lot of these individuals are low-level, nonviolent offenders. What they care about is the bottom line. And we see it on a larger scale when it comes to for-profit prisons, but we still see it in, you know, publicly funded or public jails and prisons as well.
Yeah.
So I have more details for you guys.
This is a It feels like what was revealed to me in this article was something that it happens large enough that it affects things. Because this is one of those things you see in movies, or you just know if you, I don't know how much you guys ever driven across country, but growing up, I mean, I'm one of five kids, so there was no flights if you're going somewhere, we're driving. And also, I just like, I've done it with friends too. You've driven across states. And when you drive through small towns, you the rule, do you guys know the rule? You drive through a small town, don't speed. I mean, a small town being you're driving through it for 5 to 7 minutes. And it's a part of the interstate. And when you, the sign says speed limit 40, you do not go 42. Mm-hmm. They will pull you over and they will ticket you. They will get you because that's a big source of the revenue. So it's just the degree to which that's now stretched out where you know you do it with incarceration is what I didn't understand, how much it may affect that. You know, you don't want to do anything wrong in a small town, they're going to get you. The local sheriff is going to get you and you can put you in jail. You know, so it's just the way it happens, but I didn't know it was going to get to that point.
It's getting worse. So let's go to graphic 11. I want to give you some actual stats that were found through this study, which by the way was done by Vera Institute of Justice and the Safety and Justice Challenge. So graphic 11, the numbers show a dramatic increase over the last 25 years in the proportion of people being held in jail while awaiting for trial, those still presumed innocent, but who cannot afford bail or haven't been assigned it. So this NBC News piece on this issue highlighted a few specific examples. And one of the examples that really stood out to me had to do with a woman by the name of Jessica Jaunch. And she spent 93 days in a jail in Mississippi on drug charges before she got to see a judge. She's now suing the state over her criminal case, which was dropped after a police video revealed that she was actually innocent, okay? And so, first of all, we're supposed to have the right to a fair and speedy trial. And the fact that she was behind bars for 93 days before she got to see a judge is absolutely ridiculous. And it, of course, is even more ridiculous considering the fact that she was innocent. She lost 93 days of her life behind bars for something that she didn't
do.
3 months. 3 months of her life. And think about the ramifications of that. Think about the fact that she probably lost her job, right? Mm-hmm. You're in jail. You're in jail. That's gonna destroy your reputation.
There's a psychological effect.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I'm glad she's suing, and I hope that there's justice served. But look, if it is a low-level offender and it's a nonviolent offender, there needs to be other solutions than just throwing them in jail, right? Because that doesn't make the situation better at all. Okay. I feel like jail should be reserved for people who serve a threat to society, who are a threat to society. And unfortunately, that's not what our justice system is about. It's very punitive, and there is a profit motive, and it's a huge problem.
Yeah, and what the researchers pointed out really well is that of the basically 2,000 rural counties that they surveyed, so the rates are going up. So it jumped from 49 per 100,000 people in 1970 to 265 per 100,000 people in 2013. Mm-hmm. If that isn't an alarming pattern that we are seeing an increase, like that's insane.
And it's gonna get worse under this administration because of the fact that they are, you know, they're very.
It's a for-profit administration.
It is a for-profit administration.
We just were talking about this with education. Why would it be different when it comes to incarceration? I know that this is an issue that you care a lot about, Anna. So I actually had a question for you because in this, they're sort of alluding to some of the bigger contracts out at play for for-profit prisons. And I was wondering, have you ever read through a contract and how it's worded?
I have actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
So there are a lot of different issues with these contracts. And one of the issues that comes up over and over again is these like capacity at capacity clauses or you know just the portion of the contract that indicates that the state must provide a certain number of inmates for the institution, and the whole point of that is so they can make their money, right? Mm-hmm. And the worst thing is that now there's an incentive structure to put, you know, nonviolent people behind bars and essentially ruin their lives and ruin their families' lives. But another terrible part about all of it is, let's say you don't have enough inmates or incarcerated people to fill those beds, the state has to pay for those unused beds. So these private companies, which by the way are funded by taxpayer money, they're not really privately funded. I mean, they have investors, you know, but they're not privately funded. they get their money one way or the other. Either you incentivize imprisoning more nonviolent people, or you get paid anyway, even if the beds are unused.
Weird how business works like that. It's a capitalist society where business, you take a risk and you have to put in work, you have to set up your business correctly that it'll make money. You have a structure where you're gonna be successful. This is an absolute win-win.
This is crony capitalism.
At the expense of human life.
They think they're flying under the radar because they're not operating out of, you know, New York City or one more metropolitan areas. And, you know, they really have, because we're seeing how this has escalated.
Yeah.
For them, this is big business in these rural towns.
Yesterday, I was at a Google event about, you know, reforming the justice system and especially doing something about mass incarceration and imprisoning, you know, nonviolent drug offenders. And, you know, there was a woman who's been behind bars for over 20 years. Her name is Miss Alice, and she lost her job at Federal Express. She was a single mom. She was desperate. And she had never used drugs. She had no interest in drugs. But since she was desperate, she got involved in selling, right? It was her first offense. She gets caught. It was her first offense. She was found guilty of drug conspiracy, and as a result was given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Life sentence without the possibility of parole. That was her first offense. And, you know, I'm bringing her story up right now because that's 20 years of her life gone, right? And when Obama was granting clemency to all of these nonviolent drug offenders, she was certain that she would be granted clemency because she has a perfect record. She has been a model incarcerated person, and she's done amazing things behind bars. Like, she's gotten an incredible education, she's an ordained minister, she's a role model for a lot of young girls that end up in the prison system. And it doesn't matter how good of a person she is. It doesn't matter that she managed to get rehabilitated in a system that is not rehabilitative at all. It's punitive and punitive, period. And it's not punitive on accident. Our recidivism rate isn't high on accident. Our recidivism rate is high on purpose.
They need it.
They want to make their money.
Yep.
And it's just sick. So these are things that I just want to put on everyone's radar because it's important to address it. It's important to find solutions for it.
I don't want to stretch it too far, but there's the way that our society approaches people in general, and then it has the fear-based thing, and then the law and order president, the law and order attorney general, and then the war on drugs. What pictures come in people's head when they think of this? They don't think of their kid that goes to the suburban school, I'm just saying. So it makes it even easier for them to shove people into the dustpan of a prison for 20 years at a time, because like, who cares about these people? No one's gonna fight for them. And you were saying she was expecting maybe the clemency. Didn't come, did it?
No.
For a lot of people, it didn't for her, but no one's gonna say, hey, I remember this woman who totally shouldn't be in the position she's in, but they're gonna go, but she did the crime, gotta do the time. We know those slogans, we've been hearing them our whole lives. So the support for this, we don't even realize the support that our general society has for this system of capitalism for destroying lives, ending lives.
Yeah, that's why you need to have a system of government that isn't corrupted by corporate influence. You need to have elected officials who actually represent the best interests of the electorate and the American people in general, right? And that's not what we're seeing right now, and it's really sick.
There's so many levels to this. It's crazy. Watch the 13th.
Yeah. All right. We're a little short on time, so I actually might skip ahead. Let's go ahead. Let's do the last story because I really wanted to make sure we cover this. Okay.
Yeah.
A Missouri lawmaker wanted to show just how against abortion he is by killing a live animal on camera. Yeah, all right, so the video that we're about to show you is graphic. It's difficult to watch, especially if you believe in animal rights and you don't like watching animals getting killed. But this is Missouri State Representative Mike Moon. He is a Republican, and in the past, he has supported legislation that essentially grants a zygote the same constitutional rights as a living, breathing, viable human being. And he makes his, you know, extreme point of view very evident in the video you're about to watch. So let's just take a quick look.
When the governor called for the second special session this year, I was right in the middle of my summer job. But like any good career politician, when I get the call, I'm going back to work. God gave man dominion over life. He allows us to.
I had to cut out of it early. You get the point. He later on starts talking about abortion as he's cutting this chicken into pieces.
I think ripped his heart out, all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So he's getting criticism for it. He's like, oh, the people criticizing me probably don't understand what abortion is. Yeah, abortion's a little different, right? There's a difference between a living thing, which, by the way, I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, so I know that it's a little hypocritical for me to be like, you know, a chicken's a living thing, but it's different from a zygote. It's different from a zygote. It's different from a zygote. If that woman, right, somehow expelled that zygote from her body, it would not be a living, breathing, viable thing. It wouldn't be. It wouldn't be. It's not the same thing. I am so tired of these middle-aged white dudes trying to pretend like they know anything about anatomy. You know nothing. You know nothing. Killing a chicken for shock value isn't going to help your cause, at least among people who know the difference between a zygote and a living, breathing human thing that isn't attached to something in order to survive.
Anyway, just had a conversation about our criminal system and our jails and how we throw lives away so quickly that way, as long as it's to make some money.
Was he outraged when an unborn baby died in one of Sheriff Clark's prisons in Milwaukee? Was he outraged by it?
No.
Did he say a single word about it? Did he denounce Sheriff Clark about it? A woman went into labor in a prison in Milwaukee, begged for medical attention. She's going into labor, begging for medical attention. Did this guy say anything about it? She was denied medical attention. Her baby died. But I don't hear any conservatives talking about it. I mean, conservatives can't stop filleting Sheriff Clark. They can't get enough, right? You really care about life? You really care about life? You guys run around talking about individuals who need public assistance as if they're like, you know, the bane of your existence. You don't care about lives.
Yeah,
okay, but for a second, let's just take all that away. This argument isn't even clear.
I was trying to figure out what the hell it is.
Because to be honest, like, I was like, oh, Anna got it, cool. Because Amir and I talked about it on Pop Trigger today, and we ended up in some wackadoodle discussion about was it the chicken or the egg? You know why? Because this isn't a clear argument. Like, I'm very impressed that you were even able to draw the conclusions you were able to draw from that video. Because I watched it and I was like, wait, man has dominion over life, but isn't he technically pro-choice because he's choosing to end the life of that chicken? Like, what is happening here?
I know, exactly.
This doesn't make sense to me. And he's saying that he came back from his summer job as a chicken farmer? Maybe, okay, but what does that have to do with you being a representative? And also, you're not complaining, but at the same time, you are kind of complaining because, you know, you're one of those things where it's like, I don't mind coming back from the set. Like, dude, I just can't believe that you even understood what the point he was trying to make.
I have no idea what
was happening.
I understand his point simply because I know who he is and I know what type of policies he's pushed for in the past. So even though his argument doesn't make a lot of sense, I know what he's trying to get at. And look, my biggest issue is that we're supposed to live in a country that is not dictated by any one religion. So if you have a religious issue with abortion, I totally understand. Don't have abortions. You don't have abortions. Your wife shouldn't have an abortion. Okay?
Those chickens.
The women around you who also believe in your religion shouldn't have abortions. I would never go to a woman who's pro-life, who's pregnant and pro-life or anti-abortion and tell them, no, my religion says that you have to get an abortion. Overpopulation, unacceptable, abortion right now. I would never do that because that's what crazy people
Let's
do.
Let's go to the chicken. Right? Some people don't eat meat, as you point out, vegans.
This looks like
And this guy wants to strip his chicken and eat his chicken and eat it, right? I don't want, if I'm a vegan, I don't want to. There's no forcing on whichever way you want to do, what you want to do with your chicken.
Just let people
choke it.
Live their life. Yeah, go
this looks like a scene from The Handmaid's Tale. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, it
that's
is.
All I'm saying.
All right, we're out of time.
It begs the question, what does come first, the chicken
or the egg?
All right, guys. Check out the postgame show if you're a member at tytnetwork.com/join to become a member. You get access to archives of the show, postgame, all that stuff. Anyway, all right. Love you guys. Have a great night. Thank you to JR and Grace. And are you ready for the
Butt
one,
talk?
Two, three? Bye-bye. Bye.